Thank you all for even being here. Final day, final talk. So curious why I put myself at the very end, but I did not want to punish anyone else with this slot. So here I am. I'm going to go through, we're going to jump back this map a little bit, and I guess it's almost like we're going to sum up a lot of what we saw earlier. We're going to tie in a lot of how we do CalVal in Texas that Mike presented with some of Andreas's work, back to some of how the satellite gets retrievals, and we're going to do an airborne fields campaign. So it's really kind of a good, I guess it really does sum up what we saw today. Continuous moisture fields. I've been having a lot of discussions with my fellow soil physicists at the meeting all week, and the complexity of going from what we're all used to in our one-dimensional soil profile that we usually measure and how soil moisture gets attenuated with depth, to what we're dealing with now, which are these continuous soil moisture fields that go out across the ground and gridded products of soil moisture. And our role, or our goal as the on-ground people, is to be able to validate the models, the land surface models that are now supporting everything from river forecast centers to climate models to weather forecast centers. How do we validate these data, and how do we validate satellite data? They're both sort of intrinsically gridded, and we're sort of always in a soil pit. So we need to be able to validate products like this. We need to be able to utilize continuous soil moisture fields in operational settings for stakeholders. We have to make sure that these are important to them, that they can use them. And right now, you know, it's a stretch. People don't know what to do, myself included. What do you do with gridded soil moisture data? Particularly, what do you do with it when you're talking about 0 to 5 centimeters? At 36 kilometers. It's a very challenging thing, not to just measure or monitor as we'll be showing here, but how do you use that if you're actually doing a river forecast or you're looking at water resources at a regional or even continental scale? Of course, our buried sensors are point measurements. They're all biased depending on soil type, and they're difficult to maintain. So it's obviously we're never going to produce gridded soil moisture products based on point sensors in the ground unless somehow we had millions and billions of dollars and thousands of field technicians. It's never going to happen. So we have to accept that remote sensing products are the way we're going to do this, and land surface models are the way to do this. It's really our job to take the buried sensors and be able to come up with estimates of what fields at 3 kilometers, 6 kilometers, or 9 kilometers, or 36 kilometers may actually look like. But of course, we all know within those footprints, there's a huge amount of variability. The soil types change, the land use changes, the topography changes. And so this variability, that's even within these footprints, we have to somehow take into account while we're using our soil moisture sensors, as Mike showed. But generally, as when SMAP came on and decided that they were going to have a mission statement that said we will produce soil moisture within 0.04% of on-ground stations, they failed at the acknowledgement that there wasn't a whole lot of on-ground data to actually calibrate against. This is what we have. We had currently before. About 2014, pretty much. We have scan sites, we have the Oklahoma Mesonet. We have a lot of sparse data, but we really need to have dense data to be able to upscale. We need to have more than one sensor within a SMAP pixel, which leads us to our partnership with Jet Propulsion Laboratory to build such a facility. In the bottom right is our field area. It's a 36 by 36 kilometer area that we call TEXSON, the Texas Soil Observation Network. And you can see we increased soil moisture stations in Texas a lot, almost doubling or getting about 50% more in there. So our first goal was to provide good data. Second goal was to make sure that the good data that we get from SMAP is well situated and calibrated over Texas. So we began this observational network just over a year ago in 2014. We were completed in about 3 months, getting our 40 stations installed. And we have a series of replicates within the 36, 9 kilometer, and 3 kilometer footprints, which I'll show you in a little bit. We, of course, have to validate the sensor data to field in laboratory, gravimetric water content sampling, and some lab experiments we're doing. But what we're going to kind of show here is some NASA airborne field campaigns we did over the area, which used a simulated SMAP on an onboard a plane. And we're also doing some LIDAR, and we're expanding the network as well. Those are just kind of highlights of our network. But first, we had to find a place to put things and kind of determine what we were going to do in Texas. So this is the middle Colorado, where Pedro was just talking about the Brazos, which is just the north of there. This is an area called the Texas Hill Country. pretty much all of our water sources, our water resources for Austin and San Antonio originate in these areas of upland highlands, which have a series of lakes and reservoirs. We believe there's a strong tie into how much water gets into those reservoirs based on soil moisture storage. But our ultimate goal was to have replication, and one of this is the easy-to-grid, the way this map data is produced. The yellow triangles are corners of the 36-kilometer grids. The smaller ones inside there are the nines. We wanted to pick one of these 36-kilometer areas, replicate soil moisture at the various footprint sizes, and produce a product or a weighted mean that has a standard deviation to give SMAP a target. We decided that we didn't want to stick with just 5 centimeters, which is the mission requirement, but we wanted to also have some soil moisture depth in there, so we have sensors at 10, 20, and 50 centimeters. We're really working on the upscaling, but their goal is here, can we upscale the 1 pixel of SMAP? Here's the layout of all of our stations, and those two little smaller boxes are our dense networks that are within 9 kilometer cells. So we have a sort of a wide spatial pattern that covers the whole 36, then we have a whole bunch of sensors that are inside each of those 9 kilometer cells, as well as we have a couple of 3 kilometer cells in there as well. And as we mentioned earlier, we no longer have radar products, so having the high density within the 9 kilometer cells is, it's kind of sad now because we really can't do anything with them. We're really only validating that 36-kilometer cell. The way we looked at the variability and how we're going to handle that within the SMAP footprint was to really look at the soils map. That's a map of soil water holding capacity, and you can see blue is particularly deep, lots of water holding capacity. Red is very small, shallow water or low soil water holding capacity. The Texas Hill Country is known for having shallow soils. This 36-kilometer footprint that we chose along the Pardinales River really has a nice dichotomy between shallow soils, hill slope soils to the north, very shallow limestone underneath them, with sandier soils along the river valley that are very deep and well-drained. And then, of course, we picked our 9-kilometer pixel within both of those. And we tried to sample. You want to get as much variability as you can out of the soil moisture probe so that you make sure that you're covering it. We chose to look at the predominant soil types across the area, ranging from brackish soils, which have a fairly high clay and silt content, down to some of the Pardinales fine sandy loams, which have a much higher sand content. So our goal, can we cover all these different textures? Can we use the texture to upscale and come up with a good mean and a good standard deviation? Of course, the nice thing about the area is we have these are our top 10 most dominant soil types in the area, and we're covering 84% of the area with just having these soil types, which is allowing us to use soil-specific calibrations for our sensors as opposed to having to go to every station and develop the calibration curve, which we'll do anyways, but right now we're just trying to get that soil-specific calibration done because it takes a long time to do these in the field and not just simply in the laboratory. Really quickly, how we set up our stations, we're augering with a 12-inch diameter auger down 3 feet, instrumenting in the uphill side of the profile, backfilling, running everything 30 feet into a enclosure, and everything has cellular communications back to UT, where we process the data every hour and then feed it directly into the JPL's CalVal program. We're using Camel CS655 sensors, which I know we'd all like to talk about. Well, maybe we all want to talk about sensors. Maybe we're all bored of that. But I like to talk about it, but we're not going to talk about the 655 sensor in this talk. So here's our first, the easiest pass of how we're upscaling our data right now, simple inverse distance weighting. The key is when we have clusters of data, we can't just give them all the same. We can't just take the arithmetic average of them very easily because inside of our 9-kilometer boxes, we have a lot of data. And if we give them all the same weight, soil sensors that are close to each other really get overestimated as opposed to ones that are spatially distant when we have a large spatial area we're covering. So that's just how we're inverse distance weighting. It's basically that you can see inside those, I think I can use my pointer maybe. Inside one of our boxes, we have overlapping spheres. We generate a circle around each point that's a kilometer large. Another point over here, if they're touching, then we krieg in between them, or we use the inverse distance weight to weight them in between. Then we sum up, all of these are 1 kilometer or 100 meter pixels, then we can sum up and come up with a mean and a variance for every hour of every day, and then compare them to what the satellite overpasses are doing as well as our airborne cameras. Produces data like this. I'll show a couple of these here. So the black line is the arithmetic mean in this case. The blue is the standard deviation across all of our sensors without any weights. This is for over the whole 36-kilometer area. The problem that we have with some of this is that you have a mean floating right around in here at, say, 15%, but you have a variance that's equally high. And the goal is to not give NASA a very easy target. If we say, well, you have to on this particular day, it was 10% plus or minus 10%. That's a pretty wide range for a satellite target to hit. We want to be able to hone in on a very narrow range, albeit even if the variance is high, we want to be able to make sure that we're producing the right error bars. Here's our quick inverse distance weighting. You can see if I flip back and forth, simply by inverse distance weighting, you can reduce that variance a little, but it's surprisingly small. So the goal is the inherent variability that we're seeing here real or is it not? So this is where an airborne campaign came in. And we've seen this before, even though Mike says that his site is now producing better soil moisture data in comparison to SMAP, we still think Texan's doing really good. So we'll have to see how the next cowbell meeting goes. If they shifted their grid to make it a little better. We haven't put in our new calibrations for each of our sensors, which may reduce the variance a little bit, but it may also shift some of our lines around. Right now we're using factory calibrations in all these. But we did have good reproduction of our means. When we do gravimetric sampling, the blue line is the mean over the network. The red dots with the big error bars, that's the gravimetric sampling we did during field campaigns. The initial ones were when we were pre-built out, so that's before we had the whole network done. So the bottom left shows our regression, which is there's correlation, but it's not great. When we look further to the right after we're built out on January 1st, we get this beautiful correlation between our gravimetric sampling and our in-situ sensors over the whole 36-kilometer area, which I think is great. Not quite done yet. And we have a lot of bias when we look at mean relative differences. We have a lot of really wet stations. Despite being able to reproduce the mean and having high variance, we have a lot of wet stations. These are 100% wetter than the mean, basically. So to verify this, we quickly ran out with the SMAP simulator PALS, which is located in Texas, which gives us really good opportunities to have them come by quickly and run occasional grids for us. It's basically the SMAP satellite all wrapped up on the bottom of a plane, circled here in yellow. We can do flew it about 1.5 kilometers, which gave us 6 passes to produce this type of map at 1 kilometer resolution. So these are 4 different dates. Here's our time series. Here's day 1, day 2, day 3, and then day 4. So we covered a slight period of drying, followed by a long period of wet, which would have been great to have some overflights in there, which we missed, followed by a period back here in June. These are red spots. These red bars now are the PALS overflight data average. The black line is our in-situ mean. So you can see they're falling pretty good. Right here, there's a wet period that we didn't get in the in-situ that PALS got. And down here, there was a wet period in a smaller 9-kilometer grid that the in-situ got that PALS didn't get, which we can somewhat see here in our wet spot on the top right, which the in-situs did not get and PALS did. So we're still working on some of this. The heterogeneity is much higher in the in-situ. These are cumulative distribution plots for the blue for the in-situ, and the PALS are these nice smooth curves. So you can see the means are very similar, 0.2 basically, plus or minus 0.1, which is high for our in-situ and much lower for PALS. So we're working on cleaning up some of this data and determining how the variance is real or not. I won't show you that one, but it's no one likes to see bad correlations, but we have some. In summary, we have good correspondence in these means. The spatial means at 9 and 36 kilometers are really looking good. When we start to focus in, we lose correlation, particularly even at the 1-kilometer scale, as well as our in-situ sensors right now seem to be biased wet. So we're going to hopefully clean these up with some real calibrations to gravimetric sampling, which may smooth things out there on the wet side and may not. The network itself is expanding. We have a new watershed north of Austin, about 120 miles, that will be beginning instrumentation next month or so, as well as a recharge study using a bunch of eddy covariance stations. So with that, I'd be happy to take a question if there's time.
have until you take off.
Oh, yeah, I guess if nobody wants to leave, then we can
take. You have a flight. So, we have any questions for Todd? He said he'll miss his flight and stay one more day.
It's no problem. Holy.
Yeah, it's probably less a question than a comment. So all your results you showed, the comparisons with your point measurements, they were all in the upper 5 centimeters of soil, right? I don't think that it's possible to really get less error than you indicated. It's like going to the beach, dipping a thermometer in the ocean and trying to predict
That's a very good point, Willie. Yes.
I think all the stations have precip as well.
Oh yeah, we have good precip, and we're going to go deeper. You know, that's a lot of this is to calibrate land surface models as well. So hopefully, a simple land surface model, not an overly complicated one. But we'll get to the root zone, and we have this Map Root Zone product is actually doing pretty good when we in the CalVal for our site right now. They drive a data simulation model from SMAP at 9 kilometers, hourly time steps. It's a huge data set, but it's out there as well.
A gentleman in the sweater vest has a question.
Have you observed much variation in precipitation spatially across your footprint there?
Yes, it's been very, very. You can see it in the PALS data even. It's we have a wet corner and a dry corner for sure.
But and I'm wondering about what kind of you try a couple different weightings, like arithmetic average or different weightings, but
it's real.
If the weighting is somehow how do you account for those precipitation patterns?
Well, the precipitation doesn't really. It doesn't hit the weighting so much, but it keeps the variance high for each of those time steps. And I don't know that I like to believe that we can get some of there's some time stable bias in some of the clay, more clay rich areas that just are producing higher values. I think from the sensors just being overly affected by the clay content in them, and that the gravimetrics are actually maybe 5 or 6% lower than that, but that's not going to necessarily lower the variance because we do have that climate effect that's there. Go ahead, Oli.
Maybe somebody can help me, but I really have a problem with these calibrations. The point measurement is done at a very, very small scale, and you compare that to a remotely sensed image over a large area where many, many other processes happen. And you have this point measurement at a very small scale, and you try to regress it against a larger area. I don't really see the effect of calibration. I think we need to look into different ways. I think we need to look into aerial changes. The calibration itself doesn't tell us a lot because a meter away from the point sensor, the situation is different.
It is, and as part of the CalVal program, so the gravimetric sampling. That goes on with each of the overpasses or each of the flights covers a very large spatial area. And for instance, we'll go to one site and we'll take a lot of measurements within a 100-meter radius of that, and we'll take all of that and boil it down into one number with yet another standard deviation. But then we kind of ignore that one. So we can get a little further than our point measurement, than our 1 liter, but we're still only talking about 100 meters maybe that we're covering. But until we get the Cosmos rover or another version of a portable system that can move and quickly cover large areas of terrain, we're kind of stuck with this.
I'll speak to SMAP's perspective. I think I can. They basically, it's, do you believe that you can represent an area with a significant amount of sampling? And there's been studies that have shown and measured the soil. There is an average soil moisture in a geographic domain. How many points do you need to take to do that? And that varies depending on the landscape and climatology of the area you're studying. The minimum amount can be down around 18 points or so. Practically speaking, that can be difficult, but Todd has 40 points in his domain. So with 40 points, is that enough to accurately estimate the average at a single point in time across a large scale? And this kind of goes to Tyson a little bit. That's one point in time, and then you continue that on into the future. And if you only did one site in the country or the world, you'd really have a question. But that's where Andreas comes in and coordinates. How many different sites does Andreas coordinate? Up in the 30s, 40s? So you're going into many different landscapes, many different climatologies, landscapes, so you're just hitting it with statistics. You're doing as much as you can across a wide variety of circumstances, because that's what you're going to see in real life. So yes, I say you get a different measurement 5 centimeters away, but that's why I have 40 stations. I don't have as many as Tom. So that's why I'd love to have 40 stations in a domain. You know, do I need 60? Okay. At some point, you have to decide, I have enough, and I can accurately represent across a large scale, because the metric that Andreas is looking for is a 36-kilometer footprint. That Gino is looking for is an 800-meter diameter footprint for the Cosmos station. There has to be some place that you can agree that enough points is reasonable. Or then you can talk to someone who does hyper-resolution modeling and ask for a 5-centimeter model, and then find a supercomputer. But then you're running up against Sergo data and DEM data and vegetation data at 5-centimeter scale. So it's where engineering, I'm an engineer, so I'm trying to get to that. So I think we probably have enough questions. If you have any more, you want to tell me I'm wrong, that's fine. Everybody else does. My wife does. Thank you so much for sticking around. Everybody really kept on time, except for some people. And,
sorry.
And hopefully we see everybody next year.
Yeah.
Or at EGU.